Pleasure to be with us, some from different areas, quite a few miles away. I know that the congregation Fayetteville Road has discontinued their service tonight for that very reason, and we certainly appreciate that, and glad to see all of you who've come to be with us. We have one tonight here from Wedowee, too, that we are glad to come from that long distance away. So for your presence and for your continued interest in the Lord's Word and the study we're having, we are certainly delighted. I know that some of you have not been here yet before, and some of you have been but missed the last night or two. I'd like to briefly review what we're talking about in the book of Revelation. Revelation, as we discussed earlier, is a word that comes from a Greek word, which means the revealing of what has been hid. Now, these things have been hid to the human race from the time of beginning of creation. But God knew these things would occur, and so He has revealed them to us now finally, through His Son Jesus, who gave these words to John, who in turn writes these words for our benefit. So these things are for our benefit, and we are thankful that we can look into them and see what God had in mind. There are several views about Revelation, about what it covers, about the time span that it pertains to. Some think this covers only to basically 70 A.D., when Jerusalem was destroyed. Some think it refers to a time, which we're going to talk about tonight, at which Rome lost its significance as a major city in the Roman Empire when the seat of government was moved to Constantinople. And some think it goes up to about the middle of the 400s. Then there are those such as myself who feels like that the book of Revelation is simply an unfolding of it now 2,000 years of history. And when the Bible spoke about in Revelation chapter 1 verse 10, the Lord's day, we can put that in other words and speak about the day of the Lord. We talk about Abraham's day. We talk about my grandfather's day. We talk about our day. We talk about the era of time in which we live. And the Lord's day, spoken of here in Revelation, I feel like, simply means the unfolding of the Christian age before it ever occurred. And that's what prophecy is. Prophecy is a revealing of history before history ever took place. And then history is a record of what took place, so history interprets Revelation. To me, it's very, very simple. And what we need to know is history so that we might be able to allow history to be the key that unlocks the mysteries of Revelation. We mentioned last night, too, that the Bible in many, many places, including Revelation, speaks in terms of signs and symbols and things of that kind. And we explained last night that that's not really anything to worry about, even though sometimes we don't understand those. And the reason why is because today we use the same type of expression ourselves. We may not realize we do, because we understand what we're talking about. It's all around us. We see it every day. And it's so commonplace to us that we don't recognize it when we see it in the Bible. Let me explain that to you. As I explained last night, if you drove here on the automobile, there's something on your dash that is so common to you that it really is not a question in your mind. Let me give one example of it. There's something on your dash that when you turn your key on, it looks like a little oil can. And it is. There's a little drop of oil coming from it. Now, it doesn't say oil, but it tells you the pressure there of your oil in your engine, or it gives you a red light if it's not proper. There's something there, too, that shows you something that's over hot and too hot, and so that's the temperature in your car. There's something on your dash that is from a very small beginning, and it widens and gets a lot bigger and bigger and bigger on your radio. That means your volume, when it's on the very small part of that little sign there, shows you that it's very quiet. But as you turn your volume up, you get louder and louder and louder and louder because the little lines go wider and wider. Now, that's nothing in the world but a symbol. And they don't say loud or soft, but that's a symbol that shows you that your radio can be tuned either louder or softer. Now, we have so many things like that. We mentioned a road sign last night. A number of other signs that way. For an example, as you came over here, you followed a yellow line on the highway. And those lines are spaced apart, one after the other, by a break in the paint, and then you have asphalt. Then another little space of yellow, then another little space of yellow, another little space of yellow, all divided by asphalt. But all along, there's a solid line next to these little spaces of yellow. That means you can't pass. Now, there's no sign there that says you can't pass, but you know that's what it means. That's just a symbol. So we have all kind of symbols all around us. So when we see symbols in the New Testament, don't worry about saying there's something I can't understand. You can understand it. But it must be put in the context of what's under consideration, and it must be in the context also of the sequence of history as history unfolds. In other words, the book of Revelation really starts at the beginning of the Lord's church in 30 AD and just unfolds through history of the various stages through which the Lord's church is going to go. We showed last night that the seven churches of Asia really were seven real churches. But there were actually nine churches there. Not seven only, there were nine in the same area. You have Colossae down next to Laodicea, and you have Troas way up in the north. Now, those two churches left out. Why? Is God not concerned about them? No, that's not it. Were they not important? No, that's not it either. You have a whole book written to Colossae. We find in Acts chapter 20, verse 7, about Paul meeting with the church at Troas. And so we have several references to places just like this. But the Lord didn't need but seven, because seven is a symbol that shows completeness. Now notice, if you would, we didn't say this last night, but if you look at Revelation chapter 1, and you'll notice that there were seven sevens mentioned. To begin with, and all through Revelation, you're going to find a repetition of seven sevens. Seven is simply a number of completeness. So, he takes seven churches, symbolic of problems and things that existed back then, talks about their needs, but then he projects this as seven distinct periods of time in the Christian age through which the church is going to go. Now, first of all, there was a church where there was growth and there was prosperity. And then there began to be persecution along the time of the church of Smyrna. And then in Pergamos, there began to be a falling away and a drift from the truth. And there was early corruption by the time of Thyatira. And then we come to the time of Sardis, and the church began to split apart into sectarianism and the various groups that clashed one with another. However, God saw fit at that later time, we're going to talk about it later on, about Sunday morning, maybe Saturday night, we'll get part of it, about the church returning to the ancient order as it was over here in the beginning, where God was pleased with it. And then, again, we have a drift into compromise and indifference in the condition we have in the world today, spoken of as the church era of Laodicea. So those seven churches were real seven churches, but also they were symbolic of seven distinct periods of time through which the Lord's church was going to go in all history. Now, in order to hasten what we're going to say and get to a conclusion very quickly, if you want to look and find out where we are today, I think we're right here. And we're going to talk about that and show how close we are to the end. But don't expect me to tell you when the end's going to come. I don't know. So don't expect that at all. But we are right over here. And we can pinpoint that and prove that that's where we are. How long the Lord's going to allow the world to last, I don't know. But we've come through these stages until now we're in that Laodicean era of time. We mentioned in chapter 1 and chapter 2 and 3 these matters I just referred to. And then chapters 4 and 5 tell us of a great throne scene where you have God sitting on the throne, his son Jesus on his right hand. And there's gathered before him the 24 elders, which we showed. 12 were of the Old Testament to represent the 12 patriarchs, and 12 representing the 12 apostles, showing God's plans and purposes were for all peoples of all times, both Old Testament and New Testament. And they take their crowns and put them before the Lord, showing their humility, and that God in Christ would receive the glory and the honor and the praise. Now, on the latter part of these last two chapters, 4 and 5, we find that there was a sealed book. Not a book as we know it, but a scroll. And this scroll, as it began to be rolled up, as it was being written, had seals put on it. Now, seals back in those times could be several things, but basically, it was wax. You take warm wax, you drop it into these pages, and it seals that book. And you can't read what's in there unless you break that seal. They used to seal envelopes the same way. So you continue to turn this scroll and seal it until finally, there are seven seals on it. Now, that book was brought forward, and nobody could open it. So John was very perturbed because here's a book that says something, apparently, but he doesn't know what it says. It doesn't do anybody any good at all if you can't read what's in the book. And so all of a sudden, there's a lamb that comes forward. Of course, that's Christ. He shows he was a slain lamb, and this slain lamb, Jesus Christ, is going to come forward. He's going to now break these seals and reveal to us what was in that book. And that's where we turn now to chapter 6. So in chapter 6, we begin to unfold that book with Christ doing the work of it and to reveal to us what he's talking about. Again, now notice, many, many things in the book of Revelation are spoken of in symbolic language, in symbol language, in sign language, and there are several reasons for this. And sometimes people wonder about it and they They say, why didn't the Lord just tell us things without us having to stumble over and wonder about these things that are written? Well, there are some very good reasons why the Lord didn't do that. For one thing, this book was written during a time at which there was going to be extreme difficulty and persecution. And if these things had been so evident that we could have the names of certain Caesars or certain rulers or certain nations or certain dates, it would be so evident that God's people would be exposed. And they could very easily run into all kind of trouble if these things were known. But they're written in language that cannot be understood, and the time comes for them to be understood. And then as time unfolded and these men appeared, we know who they are and what the situation is. So God many times hides things on purpose until the time comes for them to be known. Very wise that that's so. I don't mean to scare you, but just to give you a very vivid explanation of what I'm saying, God knows when you're going to die. Do you want to know when you're going to die? If you're going to die tomorrow at 9:35 in the morning, do you want to know it right now? I suppose I'd like to know it in one way, but I don't want to know it another way. It scares me to death now to know that. So you see, God doesn't tell us everything we might could use or might like to know, but he tells us what we need to know. And he gets most of those kind of things from us. So Revelation is written to tell us what's going to happen. And as those events come about, then they become very, very clear to us. And history is the key that explains what those things are. Verse 1 of chapter 6 says, and I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard as it were the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, come and see. Now, as we explained yesterday, the four beasts really are four beings, B-E-I-N-G-S. And that word is translated as beast, and it's probably unfortunate in the sense that we think of a beast as something shaggy out there with horns and long tail, but it's not talking about it. It's talking about a being. Now, these beings are similar to angels, and these are the beings that serve God in his presence, before his throne, before his feet. Now, these are four that we're going to read several times about, and they're always serving God. So now these four beasts or beings are present, and they tell John, come and see what the Lord's going to deliver to you in these open seals. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow. And a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Now, in the book of Revelation later on, we're going to read about another white horse. Now, on this white horse, there's a rider who's Jesus Christ. But this, I don't think, is Jesus Christ. So when you read of one white horse, don't confuse it with another white horse. Or when you read of one beast, don't recognize it as the same as another beast. Most of the time, these things are distinguished. But in this particular case, we don't have here Jesus pictured, but we do have a bow, and we have a crown given to someone there, and he's conquering. Now, this can refer to Christ and Christianity in the sense, if you want to, that during this period of time, during the early days of the church, the Lord's church was spread. In fact, in the book of Acts, we find in chapter 7 that Stephen was teaching the truth very boldly, and they could not stand what he taught. And so they rushed on him. They beat him with the teeth. They drug him out of the city and stoned him to death. And this is in the first four verses of chapter 8. Now, the Bible tells us that Stephen died. That's unpleasant to read about. It's something we wouldn't like to see, but it happened. And it was to an advantage, though. Because, you see, by means of this persecution that began there, the Lord's church now began to spread. It had not spread before. It had stayed right in Jerusalem, right around Jerusalem. Now, it had not gone beyond the borders of Jerusalem. It had stayed there. The church increased with numbers probably into the literally thousands there. And I think we can prove that because the Bible mentions 5,000 men. Then it mentioned multitudes more. So there were thousands of Christians in Jerusalem doing nothing, so to speak, to spread the truth like Christ had taught in Matthew 28 to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. But they were not doing that. And so by means of the persecution, then the next verse tells us the disciples were scattered abroad and went everywhere preaching the truth. We notice then they went to Gaza. They went to Antioch. They went then unto the coast of Joppa. We notice them going not long after that to Turkey and then to Greece, then up to Europe in the northern part of Greece before they got to Greece, over to Rome. Paul took the message to the island of Malta. And we found evidence when we were there several years ago in England of the gospel having reached there in the first century. So you see, they begin to spread the truth everywhere in that early first church, first century. So it seems to me that we're talking about, yes, the truth of the gospel spread during that time, but why? Well, because there was not persecution yet, to a great extent. The persecution from Rome came in the next seal. But here was prosperity. At this particular time, Rome had reached its very height of prosperity of all times. At this particular time, Rome now had reached the very peak of its perfection. This was during a time when there were three Caesars, three emperors, who were very, very capable. They were very kind and very progressive. And you read of them in a very favorable way. One of those was Nerva. The next was Trajan. We read of him today in the museum. And then another one was Antonius. Now, these were three of the emperors that were very kind, so to speak, and they were progressive. And Rome at this time, during this first century, extended its borders up to the northern part of England, that far. We've been there to see the wall that was built there. And that wall is still there. Some of it is still there. And you can see where they divided it from the northern tribes in the Scotland to between those in the southern part of England. So that wall still stands today to mark the fact that he'd gone that far in the first century. Then they have other walls in Europe as well. In Germany, not long ago, a few days ago, I was told about the wall there that was built by the Caesars. So they had extended their territory far beyond what it had before. This is the time of prosperity. So I think we can see then that the time of the first horse here, the white horse, is the time of prosperity, and the church also spread during that particular period of time as God intended for it to be. Not in Jerusalem. There was persecution there. The persecution caused it to spread. Then verse 2 tells us, as we go still farther, verse 3 tells us, and when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, come and see. And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him to set thereon to take peace in the earth. See, there was peace, there was prosperity, and that goes along with peace. But then what happens after that? You take away peace, what do you have? Now, the white horse represented peace and prosperity. Now, the red horse, as you might very well assume, means blood. Now, you might wonder how we take the liberty to tell what these colors mean. The reason why is because you're going to see just a moment he tells us that the fourth horse has a certain color and what it means. So with that in mind, we back into these other meanings. So let's allow that red horse, as it should be, to be one that denotes that there is peace taken from the earth and that they should kill one another. And that was given to him a great sword. So you see, the red horse represents death that comes from being peace removed. And then the fifth verse says, when he had opened the third seal. So the second seal then pictures to us the time of bloodshed. And sure enough, this is the time we're talking about at which there was all kind of upheaval in the Roman Empire. At this particular time, where this great sword was issued, it's a period of time of about 180 A.D. until 284. So during this period of time of 104 years, 180 to 284. During this 104 years, there were 52 men who tried to become Caesar or emperor. 52 men in 104 years. Now, of all those 52, there was only two men of those who died a natural death. Every one of the others were either killed or assassinated or in some way something happened to them unnaturally. Only two died a natural death. You can see then the internal bloodshed that was taking place in the area of Rome and those in the leading positions of it. There was at this time also a man whose name was Commodus. He was a very well-known tyrant, and he was one who pictures a great deal having to do with this trouble in Rome at that particular time. And then in the next seal, we find that John is also told again to come and see, verse 5. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. Now, if they had the white horse representing prosperity and the black red horse representing bloodshed, the black horse then, no doubt, would symbol something that comes as a consequence of being peace being taken away, of bloodshed coming on the scene, and all kind of uprising, which would mean that people are going to be in want and hunger and famine. That's precisely what happened during that period of time. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. Now, when you think in terms of balance, what do you think about? I was in the banking business for a long time, and I know that on Several years ago, we had an occasion in Birmingham to have several people in the study of the Bible every day. So we got permission from the bank to have a certain room set aside. We meet about 7:30 there every morning, 7:15, 7:30. We had a number of people, had sometimes 50 people there studying the Bible with us in the mornings. And we'd have different people doing the speaking. I do some, and different ones that speak as well. Now, we had one man there who was a black man, very, very big man, had a beard, and he was just a fine man. You just loved him to know him, like an old slave, big, quiet, humble, but he was just a fine man. Everybody loved him. So one day he was talking. He said, now, here's how it's going to be. He said, the Lord's got a big old scale up there. He says, now, on one side, he has a pan over here, and a pan over here on the other side. He says, one's for your good deeds, one for your bad deeds. He says, now, if your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, you're going to go to heaven. And if your bad deeds outweigh your good deeds, you're going to go to hell. That's the way you put it. I don't think he gave chapter and verse, because the Bible doesn't teach that. But anyway, that's his idea of a scale. Now, that's the kind of scale we're talking about, sure enough. You have a scale which has an arm on each side, and it has a pan on it. So when you put something in this side, and you put them on this side, and the balance, you know, they weigh the same thing. Now, that's precisely what we're talking about, something that weighs. But the reason why is because you weigh when things get scarce, as well as to find out how much things are worth. When things get very scarce, you want to be sure you don't waste something. That's what we're talking about here. Let's see if we can read just a moment, see what he talks about as we continue reading it in verse 6. I heard the voice in the midst of the fourth beast say, a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and see that thou hurt not the oil and the wine. So here we have a measure of the food, because we have prosperity, peace taken away, followed in by bloodshed, now followed by famine and want because of lack of food, and things would be a consequence of this kind of decrease in prosperity. Now, I don't have time to read it now, but if you'd like to, I wish you would do so. We have a passage in Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 16 and 17 that say exactly what we just said. It shows there a matter of balances being used to weigh and how scarce things were. I just don't have time to read that right now to you because my time is empty tonight. Then we continue on in verse 7 and 8. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. Now here's a horse that is pale in color, but what does that mean? Well, he tells us. And his name that sat on him was Death. So as you see, death is pale. Then you find then that black is famine. You find that red is bloodshed. And white was prosperity. And these are precisely the things that took place during that particular time in Rome's history. So we know we're right on that because world history backs us up. As we look at world history to sustain that. Then it says, and hail followed with him. Now hail here, H-E-L-L, is from the Greek word Hades. Hades simply means the place where the dead spirits go and are reserved. This is not eternal hell, Gehenna hell, but it's the place where dead persons go. So it mentions here that death and hell followed him. Power is given unto him over the fourth part of the earth to kill with a sword and hunger, with death, and with the beast of the earth. Now, at this particular time, Gibbons tells us, now some of you have Gibbons, he wrote a very interesting and a very deep and a very detailed history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. That's the name of the book. And he tells us that this particular time that half of the citizens of the Roman Empire died during this time. So Gibbons bears out with the Bible he predicted ahead of time that that would be. Then we go in verse 9. When it opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, and for the testimony which they held. Now, I need to stop in our progress for just a moment and explain something here. There are a number of views about what happens to a person after he dies. Now, we know that the body is put in the grave, or it's burned, or it's eaten by fish if he happens to die at sea. So, the body disappears, and the body decays, and the body is no longer. Now, when you put it in a grave, we understand, of course, that it's there. And if you dig that grave 50 years, 100 years, or 150 years later, according to what kind of soil it's in, whether it's been exposed or not, then there'll be nothing left of that body. And in some cases, a little bit of the skull. Not very pretty to talk about it, but that's what happened. So So you see the body's in the grave, but what happens to the spirit? Now, we won't talk any more tonight than this because we don't have the time. But the spirit of those who are righteous go to a, and I started to call it a place, and I will, because I don't have any better word than that. They go to a situation where they are separated from the unrighteous, and here's what we're talking about. Notice, they are alive, they are alert, they know, they're conscious. Now, we don't have time to study that tonight, but I want to mention it to you because notice here in verse 10, and they, now these are those who have been slain, they've been dead, they were slain for the word of God and testimony, and they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? So see, these people are dead, and these are saints. These are those who have been killed for the cause of Christ, but they can reason, they can talk, they can understand. They understand enough to say, Lord, how long are you going to put up with this? So from this very verse, and I know we're talking about symbolic language, we're talking about things have to do with prophecy, but here we do find that these people who are dead are speaking to the Lord and saying, how long? So they were not unconscious. We'll talk about that some other time if you want to, much, much more in detail. But when you die, your body goes to the grave, but your spirit goes to be in the hands of Almighty God. Not eternal heaven, but in a place where God is able to know that you're there and you're able to know also that you are. Then we go farther in verse 11. White robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season. Why did he say this to them if they were unconscious? Why did he say this to them if they couldn't hear and understand? He said, you wait a little while until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. So God says, I understand your problem. You are wondering about how long you're going to put up with this. He says, be patient. Wait a little longer. There's some more who must be killed first, and then I'll take vengeance. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. Now we're getting something that's going to be very, very interesting to read. Notice now we have come up here to a time at which we have covered the situations of the four horses spoken of. And then there's a great deal of persecution that comes along about this time in the Roman Empire against Christians. Now you remember back just last night, when you're reading Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, it says, thou shalt have tribulation 10 days. Thou shalt have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I'll give thee a kind of life. Now let's look at that again. He said that we're going to have, or somebody's going to have, tribulation 10 days. Now, what does 10 days mean? Well, as we have discussed before, and we'll mention it once again now, probably later on again too. In the book of Numbers, the children of Israel went over to the land of promise, and they spent 40 days doing that to find out what the land looked like. Now, 10 of those spies of the 12 came back and said, we can't go over and conquer the land, even though it's given to us by God. And he told us it's ours, we just can't do it. Two of them said, we can. Now, God was so displeased with them that he said, since you have not seen fit to take advantage of my blessings, rebelled against my word, then you're going to wander in this wilderness 40 years, 1 year for every day the spies are gone. So we have a day and a year ratio there. And Ezekiel chapter 4 also, he says the same thing. He says, a day for a year. So many times in prophecy, we find that one day spoken of is for a year in actual time. Now notice, you'll have tribulation 10 days. So if we let a day represent a year, that was 10 years. Now there came on the scene at this time an emperor whose name was Diocletian. Diocletian was, first of all, a very good emperor from the point of view of secular rulers. He'd been a slave. He'd risen up now to become the emperor. He was a powerful man. Start with very good. But eventually Diocletian became very, very evil, and from 303 to 313 was one of the worst times the early church went through by persecution. World history bears that out. An extremely bad time persecution-wise. From 303 to 313. 10 years. 10 years precisely predicted in Revelation chapter 3, verse 10. And then it tells us after that he was deposed. I shouldn't say that. He left the scene on purpose. He let himself cease to be emperor. He set it aside. He went to live in peace and harmony, and others took his place. Anyway, he was not there any longer. So the fifth seal represents a time of persecution. And then when we look at the sixth seal, we find something else about to happen now. And this something happens because there's a man who comes on the scene whose name is Constantine. Now, Constantine is one of four emperors that took place and were ruling at the same time. First of all, there's two. And then they got two more, so we have four. Now, eventually, they begin to fight among themselves to find out, as naturally men of war do. You want to try to find out which one of those was the chief. And so they begin to have war with each other. And sure enough, Constantine killed his own father-in-law, and who was one of the emperors. And then his brother-in-law was at war with Constantine, and he was defeated. And trying to escape with his armor, he fell off of a bridge, and he drowned. So that eliminates his competition. Constantine now comes as the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. Here's a man who's powerful, very, very powerful. You read a lot about him in world history. In fact, you can see his bust in a number of different places around because he was well known. Now, Constantine, as he began to fight with his brother-in-law, supposedly, so tradition tells us, saw in the sky a cross. And the words were, "In this sign, have victory." So the idea was he took this as an omen that I should fight in the name of Christ. Now, whether that's so or not, I don't know. But it has come down throughout the centuries as being what happened. Sometimes those kind of things get their place in history, not really true. So I don't really know about that. But the fact is, nonetheless, he did favor Christianity. His mother became a Christian. And on his deathbed, he was sprinkled. So we do see some credit, nonetheless, in this story. And so he came on the scene, and in 326, we find something happened we're going to talk about in just a minute. But before we do, I want to read these verses here that we had just come up to. As we look now to verse 12. "And I behold, when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. And the sun became dark as that cloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. And the stars of heaven fell upon the earth, even as a fig tree casteth forth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it was rolled together, and every mountain in Ireland were moved out of their places." Now, we don't know what this is talking about. That is, from reading these verses. We have here a fig tree. We have stars of heaven falling. We have an earthquake. We have the sun becoming black. What in the world is he talking about here? Well, again, understand, we're talking about figurative language. Now, so many people want to take Revelation and make all of these represent something that's real and physical in the world. Now, later on, we're going to read about something that makes a great noise. I know a brother up in Illinois. you know him too, Brother Scott. He says that these are motorcycles. Well, no, the Lord's not talking about motorcycles. But anyway, you could put just about anything you want to in these and make them fit if you want to. But he's talking here in symbolic language about something that's going to happen that seems to have the effect of an earthquake, and in effect the sun quit shining, and all these terrible things happen to us. No, these are not what's really going to happen. This is symbolic language. Read a little farther. "And the kings of the earth, and the great men, the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains, rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand?" So it looks like we have something terrible that's going to happen. And we do see that. But let's take a look at what he's talking about. As I mentioned earlier, nothing in Revelation or Daniel should scare you, because none of these things is talking about a child of God. Not any of those. These are things that are written telling us what's going to happen to those who oppose God and who receive the brunt of God's wrath, but Christians are spared from these things. So don't be afraid of these things at all. This is what happened to the other side of life, to the evil side where the devil has control, not to God's people. Now let me tell you why. At this particular time in world history, in 326, on the scene in Rome had been the succession of an empire that started way back in 750 B.C. Now they had come on the scene in 168, as we discussed a day or two ago, and they had invaded Egypt. They'd taken Alexandria. They defeated the people who were left over from Alexander the Great, and they had now entered into Jerusalem. So they are the conquerors of the world. And as I mentioned just a moment ago, they spread all the way up into northern Germany. They spread all the way into England and other places as well. So Rome now has had a vast territory, always ruled from Rome. However, Rome feels their importance and have been feeling their importance for quite some time, as we just seen, because it is a major city and a great city and a powerful city. All kind of history is in Rome. So take a look, if you would, a minute at Rome. Here's where that vast domain was ruled from, in Rome. However, way over here in Constantinople is where Constantine had been. He liked what he saw. Constantine was impressed by the area over here in Constantinople, just across the waters from Turkey. And so he decided what he would do, being emperor, being the powerful one he was. He was going to move the seat of government from Rome to Constantinople, and that's exactly what he did. Now, the name of it was not Constantinople. The name of it was Adrianople. I wonder where he got the name Constantinople. Have any idea? Constantine named it after himself. So Adrianople becomes Constantinople, and now Istanbul, as you probably know. So he moved the seat of government from Rome all the way over here. Now, what you have just read about in Revelation is simply this. The people of Rome, who have hotels, places of business, restaurants, seaports, ships, all these kind of things that they have had and owned and had profit from for hundreds of years, all of a sudden, it's dashed. It's not worth anything. Why? Because the government's moved way over yonder to the east in Constantinople. Now, let me describe that to you, if I can, another way. Let's suppose that our government decided that being in Washington, D.C., is a little bit too much exposed to the coastline. And so what we want to do is take that great city, which has a lot of history and all kind of museums and all kind of things that we have enjoyed for for 2.5 centuries, many things that we have looked to Washington for. Let's suppose now we take Washington, as it were, and move it out to the middle of Kansas, right in the middle of our nation. Now, that makes sense, doesn't it? Instead of being on one coast, it's in the middle of our nation. It's more centrally located. Less chance for invasion to harm Washington there than it would be on the seacoast. So let's just move the capital over to Kansas. Would you be in favor of that? Well, let me tell you, it won't matter to you and me, because we're not up there anyway. But all those people in Washington, the hotel owners, the restaurant owners, the land there, those who have all kind of tour services, the museum employees, if all those people lost their jobs all of a sudden because Washington shut down, it'd be a catastrophe. That's exactly what you're reading here. It's not God's people being suffering. It's the people around Rome who've been so wicked and so vile throughout the centuries and now have persecuted Christianity. They're the ones suffering the blunt of all this. So you see, these things are not against Christians. After all, it's simply signifying the fact that here in this sixth vial, in 326, Rome is moved as the capital to Constantinople. So the Roman Empire is split in two as far as the capital is concerned, and the city of Rome now begins to go downhill, as we'll see very shortly. So that's what we see here in the seven seals. Now, in the meantime, in 337, Constantine dies. And that's the reason I have that date there, because we've come to an end of that realm at the death of Constantine. The Bible doesn't say that, of course, but history tells us that he died at that time. Now, we turn to chapter 7. By the way, if you look at the bottom of the board, you'll see where we are. We've been talking about chapters 4 and 5, and then chapter 6, now chapter 7, and then later on chapter 8 and 9, and so on. So now we're going to turn to chapter 7. And chapter 7 is something I won't read because of time in detail, but chapter 7 tells us that there were four angels standing on the four corners of the earth. Now, all of a sudden, people back in ancient times said, see, the four corners of the earth signify the earth is flat. And so critics of the Bible for a number of decades now have said the Bible's wrong. The Bible's absolutely wrong because it talks about it being flat, the earth being flat, and not round like we know it is. We prove the world's round. They've gone around it in all kind of airships, and we have proved from the time of Columbus and Magellan on down, and some who thought so before that time, that the world was round. And so when you read of the earth having four corners, critics of the Bible, of course, are very prone to say, we found a flaw in the Bible, because those who wrote the Bible didn't realize the earth was round, so God, if he was God, made a mistake. Well, of course, that's not the case at all, as you well know. And as you well know also, those who profess such things as that really are have no argument at all. Because the Bible tells us in very, very beautiful language that the earth is round. It doesn't tell us for a moment it's flat. What he's saying here is simply this. He's talking about the four directions on the compass, north, east, south, and west. He's not talking about a flat plane. He's not talking about a table with four corners. He's simply using terms that we all know and all use in our compasses and on our mouths. He's talking about the four cardinal directions. So let's don't criticize God unless we know what we're talking about. You see, there's an answer to all these things, and there's a beautiful answer to it if we'll only understand that God is not wrong and is absolutely right, and there's no way for man to outguess God and to make such mistakes as that and stand. In fact, as we lead a little farther, we notice here that there are four winds. This encompasses, of course, the entire world and all those things that relate to it in every direction. That in itself shows the direction, the cardinal directions. He says that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on the tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt this earth and the sea. And he said, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till, or as we would say, until we have sealed the servants of our God in our forehead. So something's about to happen. There's something else going to soon happen. It's going to be such a destruction and such a force coming that if God's church is not sealed, then it can be blown away with destruction's coming on the scene. So chapter 7 tells us to seal the saints, give it a space of time, make sure they're sealed, they're nailed down, and they're battered to the point they won't be blown away with the wind that's about to come. And so we see the Lord's church sealed, as it says here. And I won't go in detail because, again, of time, but here he mentions 144,000. And our Jehovah's Witnesses, friends, take this to show that there are going to be 144,000 persons who are going to be allowed into heaven. Then there's going to be a great deal more that's going to live on this earth, which has been cleansed and remodeled, so that in eternity, 144,000 will be in heaven, but all the rest of us will be on this earth, a revised earth. Now, they see that in this chapter. But let's see if we can read to you what it does really say. He talks here about seating the servants, and he says in verse 4 that there are 144,000. But look at the last part of that verse, verse 4. 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. He's not talking about people in general. He's taking 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes and giving us a symbolic number of the Jews that are going to respond to the will of God, as opposed to the great number of the Gentiles. That's precisely what happened. You see, Paul says in Romans 1:16, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, the power of God of salvation to everyone that believeth, the Jew first, also to the Greek or Gentile. And then in the book of Acts, the last chapter, Paul says, as he teaches the Jews, you have rejected the word of God. And seeing you have rejected that word that came to you first, he said, we're going to turn to the Gentiles and they will hear. And sure enough, throughout history, the Gentile world has been much, much more prone to accept Jesus Christ than the Jews. So you have a limited number. He mentions an even number of all the 12 tribes, matching 144,000, symbolic round number. He says a limited number of the Jews, but a greater number of the Gentiles who will accept Jesus Christ. That's all he's teaching here. Then he goes ahead and says, as we continue on in this chapter, verse 9, after this, after the 144,000 of the Jews, I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number of all nations and kindred and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, holding white robes and palms in their hands, and cried with a loud voice, saying, salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb. So here we're not talking at all about there being a new earth in which we're going to have people live here when this earth is burned up and cleansed and purified and remodeled, and a certain limited number go to heaven. Doesn't say that at all. If you notice, he's talking about, first of all, the Jews, then he talks about the greater number of Gentiles, and salvation given to all of us, he said. It's so easy for us to read into the Bible something's not there, and of course, we certainly don't want to do that. As we turn then to the latter part of chapter 7, we notice now we start into another study in chapter 8, that talks about something else. We've talked about seven seals. Now we're going to talk about seven trumpets. Now, if you notice carefully in reading Revelation, you have the seventh chapter dividing the seven seals from the seven trumpets. Then when we get to chapter 14, notice now, chapter 7, then seven chapters later, chapter 14, we begin now to talk about seven vials, which are not two yet. So the Bible is divided here in these three sections, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven vials, by chapter 7, chapter 14. See how sevens figure this so much? You have seven sevens, you have seven chapters before, seven chapters in the middle, divided into two sections. All right. Now, the seventh seal, as you will notice here, is not used to describe anything that's going to occur, such as these events here in history. For the seventh seal, in its open, simply reveals seven trumpets. I notice, you start with the seven seals, and then in the seventh seal, it reveals seven trumpets. Now, we're going to talk about six trumpets, and the seventh trumpet is going to blow and going to reveal to us seven vials. So one unfolds into the next, which unfolds into the third. And that's, of course, a little ahead of our story, but I want you to see where we stand. We talked about seven seals. Now, the seventh seal reveals to us seven trumpets, which begin to blow. And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, again seven, and to them were given seven trumpets. Another angel came and stood in the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. So here we have God still praised and glorified, and he is being offered these prayers of ours, which are to him as incense. And the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer. Now this is changing the picture. The angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar, cast it in the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. So you see, God is praised and glorified. And then we find that on the next view, that same censer is used to take fire from the earth, fire from the altar, and throw it on the earth. Now this shows that there's going to be some kind of destruction come again. Now what's this going to be? Well, we're going to find out very shortly as we continue on. So we're about to talk about the seven trumpets, and we find out that this vengeance of God is seeing by means of casting on the earth this fire from the altar. Verse 6, and the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast from the earth. And the third part of trees was burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Now, if we take our sequence of numbers as we've been looking at them from dates, we go from 30 A.D. up to the 100s, the 200s, the 300s, we come now into the early 400s. And if you turn to your world book histories of the things of the world around us, not from the Bible point of view, secular history, you'll find that at this particular time, Rome now has moved, as you know, as a seat of government. His seat has been moved from Rome over to Constantinople. So that means Rome city is exposed. And the very next thing you read about in world history is that the Goths from the north up here in Germany and so on, they come down in an invasion toward Rome. And they sacked Rome and took what they wanted away from Rome. And that's precisely what's pictured here in the book of Revelation. Now, they came from the north under a man whose name was Alaric. They entered Rome in 410. There was a notable burning of destruction of things as they came along the way. In fact, they burned the timbers and things of that kind as they came on their way. Vegetation destroyed. You see, from Germany, in the area of Europe talking about there, it's a very, very pretty country. Rolling hills and all kind of vineyards nowadays. But back then, great trees and great forests and great pastures. And these people were barbaric. They came and burned everything on their way. So they got to Rome. They sacked Rome. Then turned around and went back. So here we find Rome in the first time in centuries of time, but they now invaded. They're weak. It's a city now. The main part of the government's over there in Constantinople. So Rome's about to fall. Rome has been an oppressor of God's people. It's been in control of God's people for hundreds of years now. It's about to fall. This is the first invasion that comes to them. Now, the man's name is Alaric, who's their leader. And sure enough, 7 days after he leaves this invasion and goes toward back home, he dies. Just a matter of history that would be interesting for us to note. And later on, that'll come up again. But notice it says here that a third of the earth was involved. Now, this is important because I want you to notice something about one third that we're going to repeat again. But he did say a third. That's really important to notice that. As we go further now, beginning with verse 8, and the second angel sounded, as it were a great mountain burning with fire, was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood. So as we look now at this next invasion, we see there was another one under consideration, and that was the sea here. Still, it was a third. On this particular situation, we find it mentioned a great mountain, and don't think in terms of a physical mountain at all, but just think in terms of the fact that we have empires and great governments under consideration. And this is true because when you read the book of Daniel, you remember chapter 2 and verse 35, it speaks about the stone which is cut out of the hand became a great mountain. So mountains many times are used to denote governments or powers, and that's what it means here, not a physical mountain with rocks and trees on it, but we have a government consideration here. And so chapter 8 and verse 8 tells us about that. And it says that the sea is under consideration here. The sea creatures died. Verse 9, a third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. A third part of the ships were destroyed. A third angel sounded, and we go to the next one now, verse 10. But verses 8 and 9 tell us that we have to do with the sea. Now, everything here talks about the sea. The earlier part talks about the verses before talks about the earth. Well, here we find some people coming from the north, and these people are called Vandals. Now, the Vandals are ones that we need to look at carefully because they came from way over in the east. They came through the middle part of Europe, and as they came down through, they crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, and having passed there, they came over to a place on the edge of North Africa called Carthage. And they stayed there for a period of time. If you look at the map, you can see what I'm talking about here. They left and crossed the Straits of Gibraltar in 429, and they stayed there for a few years, and what they did while they were there was to build ships. Because you see, they came from the land, as we see here, but here they begin to build ships. They could not approach Rome otherwise. And so from here they built ships, and then in 450, they went up across the Mediterranean Sea and attacked Rome from the river. So here we notice that the invasion to Rome this time was by means of the sea. First time by land, direct to Rome, and this time to Rome by means of the sea. This was in 455 that took place. The man's name who headed these people were called Genesaret. And also these people were called the Vandals. Now they then sacked Rome and they went back. They didn't stay in Rome. Now you might wonder where the word vandalism came from. You have it now. These were called Vandals, and they committed vandalism, and that's where we get our word today from them. Now the Bible goes further now in verse 10. The angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. It fell upon the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of water. So notice again, we have a third mentioned. So we have three-thirds under consideration thus far. Now, this next invasion is number 3. And these people came from way over in the east, somewhere we think in the area today we know of as Western China, up in that part of the world. They came across that desolate land and eventually came to the middle part of Europe, where they began to have battles with the Roman armies all up in the middle part of Europe on the rivers. And notice we had first of all the land, now we have the sea under consideration, now the rivers under consideration. And sure enough, these people that came by had all kind of wars with the Romans on the rivers. Now the man's name who was the head of this army was Attila. And of course the people who came with him were called the Huns, as you may know from world history. They came from Central Asia. They had battles with the Romans at the Danube River. They went west, they crossed the Rhine River, and had battles there. Then they met the Roman army at the Main River. They turned south and then met Italy, met the Roman army in Italy at the Po River, and came on down then and invaded Rome. And so as they came toward Rome, history tells us that they did not actually go into Rome because the bishop in Rome met them at the gate, as it were, and told them that it would be unwise for you to come into the city. And the reason why is because that there was an invader here a few years ago. Remember, we just read about him in the first invasion. And 7 days after he invaded Rome, he died. So there may be a curse if you come to the city. And so sure enough, he persuaded Attila not to come into the city. They took all kind of goods to him and gave them to him. He sacked Rome in that sense, but he turned around and left. So the point is then, of course, that he didn't actually destroy the city, but he took the goods from the city, turned around and went back over here into the eastern part of Europe to a place we know of today as the Danube River. And he established a nation we know of today as Hungary. So here we have Hungary established by the Huns, and Attila being the one who was ahead of these people who did that. Now, history tells us something interesting, I think, about him. Tells us that he was buried. He was so well liked by his men, so favored by his men, that when he died, they decided to make a fitting memorial for him by stopping the flow of the Danube River, pushing its waters back and burying him in the bed of it, and then allowing the waters to come back over. So they were going to make that his tomb. That's what history says. However, I talk with people who are from Hungary, and they say that's not true. Even though they know that world history books say that, they say it is true he was buried in a river, and I've heard this from different sources in Hungary, but they tell us it was in a river which is named Tisza, T-I-S-Z-A, rather than Danube. Now, frankly, I wasn't there, and I don't know. But these are the two stories. One said Danube, and but they say from Hungary, and every Hungarian I've talked to says it's the Tisza River and not the Danube. But anyway, the point is he was buried in the river, but he attacked Rome and, of course, returned with the victory and leaves Rome at its feet. Now, then verse 12 tells us, and the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten. Now, again, don't think in terms of the real sun up there beaming with its light on the earth. But this is spoken of as an illuminary, a man who is a prominent person, such as Attila, such as others we've read about. And it says here a third part of the moon. So now we have a third mentioned again. Now, that might be a little problem because I don't know how you can have 4/3, do you? Now, you can have 3/3, but not 4/3. Yet the Bible says here we have 4/3. So, no doubt he's trying to tell us something here that's not real clear on the surface, and I think he is. You know, you can take an orange and you can set it in 3 parts, and it makes a whole orange. You put it back together again. But if you cut it into 3 parts and make the whole orange, how can you have 4 parts? That's what we have here. We have 4 parts. But he always says there's 4/3. You can't have 4/3, you can only have 3/3. Is that right? Well, let's see. We'll go a little farther. The fourth angel sounded, the third part of the sun was smitten, the third part of the moon, the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Now we go a little farther, and we find that something occurred now. In 476, that continues the invasions we've already had. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe. So we're about to get into something different now. So let's find out where we stand with this fourth invasion. At this particular time in 476, there was a man who came from the north. His name was Odessa. He was from the people called the Herli people. Now these actually were people who belonged to Rome. In fact, he was a general in the Roman army. He's right up in the north. And he sees Rome weakened, brought to its knees. He sees how shattered it's been. He decided, I'll go down to Rome and I'll become the king myself. Sure enough, he does. Now, you remember the other invasions where the men came from outside. They invaded Rome. They turned around and went back home. Well, he comes, the general in the Roman army. He comes down to Rome. He takes Rome. He sets himself there, remains there, and calls himself the king of Rome. So Rome now comes to its knees by its own general and, consequently, we find Rome now, as the first four of the seven trumpets tell us, is brought to its end of its glory and its power. But now what we are finding is simply this, that there are not 4/3 after all of a whole. There's only 3/3 in it. But what he's telling us is this, that Rome is going to fall completely. The Roman Empire is going to fall completely when all 3/3 of it fall. So what we've talked about thus far is this 1/3 of Rome. Now, this 1/3 of Rome, sure enough, had 4 invasions. So a third is mentioned 4 times, but it's talking about this same 1/3 of Rome. Now, what we find next is there's another 1/3 of Rome down here in the south, and then there's a 1/3 of Rome up here in Constantinople. So you see, we have 3/3 after all. But then he just told us about this 1/3, which had 4 invasions in that 1/3 of Rome. We have 2 more to go. And that's where he says in the next verse, there's an angel which calls woe, 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 and reveals to us the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th trumpets, which are to blow. But we've already talked an hour and 15 minutes, so I guess we better wait now for tomorrow. You've been very kind to listen. I appreciate so much you doing so. And let's read just a little bit further before we conclude, however, tonight. We come down to chapter 13, verse 13. Now beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the 3 angels which are yet to sound. And then chapter 9 begins to tell us about the other 2 trumpets that are going to reveal something to us. And then the 3rd trumpet which blows, which reveals 7 vials which follow those. We've talked pretty fast. I hope we haven't confused anyone. If there are some questions that you want to ask or some things I haven't made clear, feel free to stay all night with us if you want to talk. We'll be glad to do that. But you've listened very, very well. We certainly do appreciate that. And very much thankful for your interest in studying these very important matters about God and His kingdom, His church, and about the events that are going to surround us as people of God in our present day, as we're going to read later on. Again, thank you for coming. As we stand to sing this song of praise to our Almighty God and Father in heaven, should there be some way we can minister to you or serve you spiritually, come forward and let us know. We'd be happy to do so. While we stand, while we sing.